Much has been said about the impact of television on the lives of everyone, not just in our society, perhaps more here because it's most developed technologically. Perhaps that may be open to question. But the effect of TV on the lives of every one of us, and yet how it's used. And the Federal Communications Commission has been too little known to the public, but thanks to one of its members, its most dynamic member, Nicholas Johnson, is more known. Nick Johnson has been described by John Kenneth Galbraith as the citizen's least frightened friend in Washington, and it's the book of Nicholas Johnson, How to Talk Back to Your Television Set, that's published by Atlantic Little Brown. That's the basis for his being here in Chicago, as well as talking to a counter-NAB convention. Nick Johnson is a public servant in the truest sense of the word. We have too many, obviously, private servants who are known euphemistically as public servants. How to talk back to your television set, Mr. Johnson. This is something everyone dreams of, doesn't he?
Well, I think so. It just occurred to me that, kicking your television set may be hazardous to your health, and therefore instructing people in the ways in which they can talk back to have greatest effect might be worthwhile. I got thousands of letters since I've been at the Federal Communications Commission. It's a 7-year term. I started in 66 and go to 73. But people write in from all segments of the society, all parts of the country geographically, all age groups, all educational levels, all income levels, all shades of the political spectrum. I mean, this is no single segment of society by any manner of means. And they're outraged. They really are. They're frustrated or demoralized. They don't know what to do about this horrible element in their lives. And they want advice on what
and
they can
what
do.
What are some of the specific complaints you point out in your book, which is based on a number of talks you've given and your own essays, and it all adds up to one piece. You're implying that the individual or group certainly can do something. But what are the basis of the complaints, some of the specifics? What's the most recurring one?
Well, people complain about whatever happens to trouble them most. Some people are concerned because their favorite television show has been taken off the air. Blacks in our society are very concerned because they think that television tends to portray a white racist philosophy in the United States. Certainly the employment practices of stations, broadcasting industry generally, is among the worst of any industry in the United States. There's a group of women in Chicago who have started an organization called Action for Children's Television. They're concerned about especially the use of children's television to manipulate little children as consumers. Other people are concerned about the quantity of advertising generally. Some people are concerned about the taste involved in the entertainment programming. Some people believe the station should do a better job of representing the needs and interests of the local community rather than simply spreading on material that's nationally distributed, whether records or film or wire service news or whatnot. Other people believe that the news side of the business needs some correction, or that we need more news in public affairs than we now have.
Because there are several, many questions arise. You point out complaints, I'm sure, that are in the minds of all listeners, say, to this program and listeners to any program. The amount of television commercials, the nature of commercials, the use of them. Children as consumers, you point out that the great majority of products are bought at the behest of kids.
I leave that to those who are listening to this, but I know it's true in my own experience, and sociologists report that apparently this is generally the case, that the children do have an influence on at least some of the purchasing of their parents as a result of television commercials they've seen, and the people who are preparing the commercials know this, and that's one of the reasons why they do it. They're very open about it. They write about it in their literature, not only in influencing the parents, but in hooking the kids at a very young age on a particular product. And the advertisers point out, if you can hook a child when he's young and hold him all his life, you can sell him an awful lot of your particular brand of whatever it may be. Sometimes when it involves something like cigarettes, they try to get the kids when they're in grade school or junior high school and get them hooked on a particular brand of cigarettes and keep them throughout their lives. There's some question about the morality of that, in my judgment.
On that subject, we'll come to this matter in a moment of news. What is free speech and what is profitable speech? You point this out to corporate censorship as well as that interests you as well as governmental censorship.
Yes.
But this matter of cigarettes, there are certain affirmative things that have happened. Now and then they happen. And you point out there was a young lawyer named John Banzeff. Because now and then we see some anti-cigarette commercials. There should be more, but we see quite a few. That is, surprisingly, you know.
Yes.
And this came about not by accident.
That's right. And it came about over the strenuous protests of the broadcasting lobby and the broadcasting industry. Many people were concerned about the rising consumption of cigarettes in this country and the apparent linking of that to various kinds of illness and producing on the order of 300,000 deaths a year. We had the Surgeon General's report. We had action by the Federal Trade Commission. Lots of comment by United States senators and others within the government. The warning was put on the cigarette packages that cigarette smoking may be hazardous to your health. And cigarette consumption simply continued to climb. More kids were picking up the habit every year. This young fellow, John Banzeff, in New York City, was a young lawyer practicing there, and he decided he wanted to do something about the cigarette smoking problem, and he decided that cigarette smoking was a function of cigarette advertising, and that somehow you'd have to get a handle on that. So he decided that most cigarette advertising was on television, and that suggested to him maybe the FCC would have something to do with it. And so he got down the laws and the regulations having to do with the FCC, and he found this thing called the Fairness Doctrine. Now, the Fairness Doctrine provides that if a broadcaster puts on any discussion of a controversial issue of public importance, he has an obligation to present all points of view with regard to that issue. It's a general principle. And it really is nothing much more than its name, fairness.
And so the cigarettes then, he was able, John Banzeff, an individual, was able to invoke the fairness doctrine because cigarette ads are controversial. That is, they say, they have a point of view.
Well, that
they
was
say a young
point.
Guy can make out with a girl, or a certain guy will have status, or a certain snob appeal, or whatever it might be. So he's saying there's another side to it.
That's right, precisely. And he says the Fairness Doctrine ought to cover this situation. As you point out, cigarette commercials put on one point of view. He said there is another point of view, and that is that cigarette smoking is also associated with lingering illness and death. The public's entitled to have that information. I think it's revealing how the broadcasting industry responded when the FCC ruled in this instance that he was right. The broadcasting industry took all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States, and with tremendous pressure on Capitol Hill and the full use of its lobbying, economic, and political power, took all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States the rather preposterous argument, or at least it was found to be preposterous by the Supreme Court, that the First Amendment guaranteed them, the broadcaster, the right to keep from the American people this information about the health hazards of cigarette smoking. Incredible position that anyone who, whether or not they were licensed to serve the public interest, would want to keep from their audience information about the hazards of the products that they were selling. Now, of course,
you mean free speech is free anti-speech.
Well, that was their argument, yeah. And of course the court just threw them out, but that they would want to make that argument, you see. And the point is that most of the products, or at least a great many of the products that are advertised on radio and television, are products that, if they don't contribute to needless deaths, contribute to injuries, illness, disease of various kind, psychological harm of various kind, mental illness rather than mental health, and the way in which the products are sold, or they're products that are overpriced, or that are going to break down and require repairs, or they have built-in obsolescence, or they won't work right, or they're products that you don't really need, that the product needs you don't need the product.
Mm-hmm.
An awful lot of stuff that's advertised of that character, if you really sit down and look at it. You know, how many things that broadcasters are trying to sell you are products which are really designed to help you, will make your life fuller and more richer and more satisfying, more constructive, and how many have some element in them that is not really designed for your own best interests? And And so the broadcasters were really quite shocked at the prospect that the public would be entitled to some truth on some of these issues, and needless to say, they fought it. And now they fought it so much that seemingly they would rather have cigarette advertisement taken off the air altogether if they can also get off these anti-smoking spots, because once you start giving the people a little bit of truth, once you put anything on radio or television that is designed with their best interests in mind, pretty soon people start comparing that with everything else, and they, you know, say, why is it that all this other stuff's on radio and television? It's out to get me, because now I know that it is possible for somebody to get me some truthful information, something designed to help me. And then, of course, the whole system crumbles, you see.
So the Pandora's box opens, and this open, or the window opens, and John Banzoff, this young lawyer, won.
That's right.
And therefore, we see a number of anti-cigarette commercials. Now, the companies, and this, I imagine, applies to the whole broadcast industry, advertisers, agencies, they say, wait a minute, we'd rather take the whole thing off, this thing, than have a truth told.
That's right.
So this leads to the nature of who owns television, who owns radio, who owns the air, because often we're told, look at the dough we spend. We spend all this money to give you this great entertainment. We come on this matter of entertainment in a moment, too. We give you all this, and you get it for free. This
well,
is the
of course
response.
That's nonsense. Yeah, that's utter nonsense. I mean, in terms of investment in this industry, the broadcasting industry has an investment in its capital equipment of about $500 million. The American public has invested in the television receivers $20 billion, or 40 times as much as the broadcasters have invested. The amount of electricity it takes to run those sets every year is not insignificant. The advertising costs are picked up in added product costs for the consumer. That runs about $3 billion a year from radio and television. So to say that this is free is nonsense. You're paying a great deal for it. The point is that the public is paying for it in ways that give it no control over the programming content. And this is true with an awful lot of what we get, but it's especially true in radio and television. There's some magazines, the mass circulation magazines, that spend, in order to get new subscriptions, more than they get from all their subscriptions. In other words, all the money that the readers pay to the magazine, plus another 25%, is spent by the magazine in order to get new subscribers. What they are doing is selling subscribers to advertisers. They're not selling a magazine to the subscribers. I heard an interesting proposal by the new editor-publisher of Scanlon, this new magazine.
Warren Hinkle.
He suggested that that what we ought to do is pass a law that no magazines could have any advertising in them for a period of 1 year. All magazines would have to be sold for enough to cover the costs of actually producing that magazine. And then he said most people would find that most of the stuff they're getting in the magazines they really don't want. I mean, you know, you can get 58 issues for 2 cents an issue or something, you go ahead and subscribe. But if you really had to pay what it was worth. So then he said after a year, after all these magazines had gone out of business, the ones that remained, people really cared enough for to buy, and he'd permit them to have advertising back again. Well, I don't know if this is altogether serious proposal, mm-hmm. but it's related to what we're talking about here, because the people really don't have much control over the programming that they get. They're not purchasing it in the marketplace as they would if we had subscription television. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the programming market does not reflect the desires of the listeners and viewers.
Our guest is a public servant, quite obviously. Nicholas Johnson, a member of the Federal Communications Commission. His comments are reflected in his new book. That's a thrilling one, disturbing, at the same time quite revealing, something we know inchoately, many of us, but chapter and verse aside of Mr. Johnson in the book, How to Talk Back to Your TV Set, that Little Brown Atlantic have published. But back to this theme of the favors that broadcasters and sponsors and agencies are doing for us, favors, quote-unquote. The air itself, I remember astonished to discover that Herbert Hoover, who was president at the time, said the air is public province, belongs to the publics, and the broadcasters, sponsors, only have a right through the public will to use that.
Yes, yes. Well, I think it was Herbert Hoover who said that we must never allow such a marvelous national resource for education, for entertainment, for uplifting cultural affairs, information for the American people. We must never allow such a marvelous instrument to be drowned in advertising chatter. If only he could listen to the AM radio band today across America. But the concept of the public owning the airwaves, obviously, is just so much rhetoric until you get it embodied in law. Well, it was embodied in law in the Communications Act of 1934. And what that law provides is that someone who wants to operate a radio or a television station must be licensed by the Federal Communications Commission. The theory behind the law is that which you just quoted Herbert Hoover as saying, that the airwaves are public property, that there is a tremendous political and ideological power associated with what is essentially a monopoly position. I mean, all the people in Chicago who would like to have a radio or television station cannot have one. There are a limited number of stations that can fit in the frequencies that are available in Chicago and that have to dovetail in with the assignments of radio and television stations in the areas surrounding Chicago. That means that those people who do have this right to make really gargantuan private profit from the use of public property have some public obligations that go with it. And the Act provides that no one can operate a radio or television station without a license, and that license term will only be for 3 years. Now, at the end of 3-year term, their right to broadcast is terminated. They don't have a right to go on broadcasting forever. Their right to broadcast is terminated. If they are going to go on, it must be renewed. They must get another license from the FCC. And the question at that time is whether or not they've been serving the public interest. And that question is supposed to be resolved by the FCC, and it's supposed to be resolved by the FCC after listening to the complaints, the commendation, the comments of people in the local community. It is, in effect, an election. All the licenses in the state of Illinois, for example, come up for renewal at the same time. As a matter of fact, if you let me look in the back of the book here, because we list all these things in the...
Nicholas Johnson, our guest, FCC commissioner. Perhaps the most, how can I put it, the most public-minded commissioner since the days of Clifford Durr, who served in the time of Franklin D. Roosevelt. But you were looking up something.
Yeah, we've got in the back of this How to Talk Back to Your Television Set a list of places where people can write for information and where they can get free materials and different organizations and things of that sort. And I've also got this list of license renewals. The licenses in Illinois expire on December 1, 1970. That's this year, December 1. Now, that's an election day. That's an election day, or actually 90 days prior to that day. Because they have to file their renewals 90 days before they expire. Now, that's an election day, and everybody in the state of Illinois not only has a right to, but in many ways an obligation to evaluate the programming performance of the stations that they listen to and that they watch, that are part of their lives, because those licenses expire on that day, and the question before the FCC is to whether or not those people ought to get another license. And if there are other people in Chicago who think they can do a better job of operating those stations, that's their opportunity to apply. And most people don't participate in that election. They don't vote in that election because they don't know what's being held. Nobody's probably ever told them
about
it.
See, this is something, this point that Mr. Johnson is making, this point you're making is quite a remarkable one, little known one. No one would dream of saying, wait a minute, we have a right, because the question, all these years I think we've lived in this fantasy world, well, that has been fed us, that these stations belong to these companies. These
That's
stations,
right.
The air belongs to them. Or the sponsor is doing us this favor.
Yeah.
And you're saying it belongs to us.
That's right. That's right. And not only does it belong to us in the sense just of talk about power of the people and that sort of thing, but it is a matter of law. There is a procedure that's set up for popular participation in the license renewal process. And that, in the ultimate sense, just as the people's power in this country, in the ultimate sense, is registered in elections for their elected public officials. That's our power over our own destiny, ultimately. And with regard to broadcasting, the people's power, in ultimate sense, rests on their capacity to participate in the license renewal process. That's why when an individual calls up and protests to a station or makes a suggestion to a station, the station ought to have to listen. If the person calling or writing knows, and the person receiving the call or letter knows, that any listener or viewer is in a position to throw that, to make a protest about that license renewal to the FCC when the time comes.
Or ask you about this matter of censorship, the double nature of it, or news, or objectivity of news, if there is any such thing. The matter of John Banzoff, lawyer, how did he do, what happened? Can you cite specifically how it happened? This young lawyer said, I object to these cigarette commercials. I want some anti-cigarette. I want equal time. I, as an anti-cigarette, who know about the incidence of cancer in cigarettes. How did this work out?
Well, that involves what I call in the book the law of effective reform.
Toward the end of the book, by the way.
That's right, and this is the last chapter called What You Can Do to Improve TV. I've got one chapter in How to Talk Back Your Television Set that's about institutional reforms, things that the Congress or the FCC would have to do, where you can write your congressman or write the FCC and urge these things. But then the final chapter is devoted to what individual citizens can do on their own. And that principally involves the license renewal process, the fairness doctrine complaints, and petitions for new rulemakings, like these women in Boston who are complaining about the commercials on children's television. They've petitioned the FCC to issue a rulemaking that would prohibit commercials on television. But I talk in this last chapter about what I call the law of effective reform. And I say that in order to get relief from legal institutions, whether Congress or courts or agencies or whether they're federal or state or local, that you first have to assert the factual basis for the grievance and the specific parties involved. Now, most people don't do that. They just write in and they say, you know, can't you do something about this? Well, the answer is that agencies can't, either that they can't do anything about it or they won't do anything about it until you say precisely what is it that you're complaining about factually and precisely who is it that you're complaining has done it. Now, the second thing you have to do is make some reference to the legal principle that indicates that some a form of relief is due. This may be a constitutional provision or a statute or regulation or a court or agency decision or whatnot. Now, finally, you need to specify the precise remedy that you want. Do you want new legislation or do you want regulations or do you want a decision out of the agency or revocation of license or fines or whatnot. Now, generally, it takes 3 years of law school to get this, you see. Yeah. And there are lawyers around who can volunteer and help in these matters, and they're terribly helpful. But you don't have to be a lawyer to participate in this process. And there are many things that you can do as an individual. But John Banzoff followed this principle. He didn't just write in and say, gee, I'm disturbed about all these cigarette commercials. He named a specific party, WCBS in New York City. He said specifically what he was complaining about, namely that they were running a lot of cigarette commercials. And he mentioned when they appeared on the air and how many of them there were and so forth. He named a specific legal principle, the Fairness Doctrine. He argued that the Fairness Doctrine ought to cover this situation. And he asked for specific relief. He said, I want you, FCC, to order WCBS to put on the air some anti-smoking commercials. So he followed these basic principles of the law of effective reform, and he got results.
What happened? He wrote to the FCC?
Well, he wrote to the FCC, but what he wrote was on 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, but instead of starting off by saying, dear Chairman Hyde or Birch, as it is now, writing a letter, he wrote at the top of his piece of paper, fairness complaint. And then he said, I wish to file this fairness complaint. I think the fairness doctrine has been violated, and I request a ruling from the FCC as to whether or not it has.
What was the reaction? How did here came the letter. You meet, there are seven of you, right?
Yes.
Now, here was this letter. Now,
well, I'm thinking, it has to be passed on. That's the point. You see, a letter can simply be a letter can simply be handed on to some member of the staff, and they prepare a form response, and you get a letter back in the mail. But a piece of paper that has legal significance, a petition for a revocation of a license or a petition to participate as a party in a license renewal proceeding or a fairness complaint or something of that sort, that's a piece of paper of legal significance, and it has to be passed upon with certain procedures. And so this fairness complaint was first sent to the Complaints and Compliance Bureau of the Broadcast Bureau at the Federal Communications Commission, and they prepare a memorandum on it recommending what the commissioners should do with it, and ultimately it finds its way up to the commissioners and we have to vote on it.
And you voted?
And in this case we voted that the fairness doctrine did apply, that John Banzhaf was right, and suddenly he found himself in possession of $100 million worth of free television time.
This is fantastic. So this really indicates, as Mr. Hoffman shows in the book How to Talk Back to Your TVs, indicates that it can be done if the proper means. In this instance, you know, also there were certain commissioners such as Nicholas Johnson there too. I think we can't deny this aspect of it too. So we come back to the question, the big question, of course, of censorship. And since the celebrated speech of Vice President Agnew, many of the companies, broadcast companies, well, this is incredible because this is governmental censorship. If you agree with him, fine. So the New York Times and the Washington Post are attacked, but not, say, the Pullman Papers of Indiana, the Tribune of Chicago, or the Manchester Leader up in New Hampshire. But you go a step further, don't you?
Well, you mean with the corporate censorship?
The whole matter of censorship. Since the Agnew speech, people, a number have been aware of the nature of censorship itself, but his speech was felt as an attack on the mass media. But you went a step further, didn't you? You said Agnew, in one way, not the way he meant, is right, if I recall your comment.
Well, yes, I my concern was was with really the motivations of what the administration is doing. I mean, I think there is, as Mayor Lindsay spoke not long ago in Berkeley, a desire to repress dissent in this country. I think it's very clear. And I think this was a part of that effort. Basically, the president wants more time on television. He wants less critical comment on television, because television is the most effective form of distribution of information and opinion in America. Every leader of every nation has always wanted the power to put out propaganda to the people undisturbed. Every leader has always wished that there were less criticism, and President Nixon is no exception in that regard, and Vice President Agnew has had a significant impact in bringing that condition about on behalf of the president.
And though there have been righteous, self-righteous attacks on Vice President Agnew and by virtue of that President Nixon, by heads of networks and station heads, which leads to a point in your book, there's another kind of censorship that they're not talking about, and that's corporate censorship.
That's right. That's right. Basically, you know, I'm just trying to make democracy work. I think it's a good system. I really do. I've got a respect for the intelligence of the American people. I think you do with this program. I think the people who listen to this program are intelligent people, and they're fully capable of listening to what you and I are talking about and what you talk to your other guests about. And they're capable of participating in that conversation, for that matter. They don't have to sit there like as if the broadcaster felt they had a 9-year-old mentality and could only listen to records and commercials tossed at them all day and a few news headlines on the hour. I think we ought to have a system in this country where all ideas can get a hearing. Now, lots of ideas that are kicking around that I don't have any truck with, but it doesn't bother me that people are talking about them. I want my ideas tested and challenged, and I want to hear points of view that I don't agree with and points of view that I hate, and I want people to criticize me. And I don't think the trade press in the broadcasting industry, Broadcasting Magazine particularly, I don't think it serves the best interests of the industry.
I think
that's another point. I'd never close them down.
I want you to continue. I hope you do in this vein. And recent incidents, which you point out to the audience who is unaware of intra-trade matters, Nicholas Johnson has been the target, unprecedentedly, might I add. Never has any public servant, no member of the FCC, been as attacked as Nicholas Johnson by certain organs of opinion that describe themselves as representative of the public that, quite obviously, house organs. And this is his badge of honor, might I say. But he's been the subject to considerable attack by networks, NAB, etc., for the very point you're making. But back to the theme. You're saying that you have faith in the intelligence of listeners, that here we have a mass medium that is absolutely, you point out in your book, that is unprecedented in its impact on us, and the possibilities. You say the tremendous possibilities in man. And, of course, thus far, the media, with few exceptions, has been appealing to the meaner, the baser, the smaller, the petty instincts of man.
I think so, yes. I think that there are very few people in our country who are operating at more than 5% of capacity to understand and to feel, to love and experience joy and contribute productively and so forth. And I think that television must bear a great measure of the responsibility for this. I mean, it's sending 100 million people to bed every night dead in the water. They just, they've been fed this diet of cotton candy programming that attracts their attention and then leaves them with nothing but an empty feeling and a toothache. And to go off to their smog-filled freeways and their grubby jobs the next day, and it certainly is not a very elevating influence. Well, my point about the censorship is that, I want all this information out. I don't want to suppress anything. I'm not trying to put across my point of view. I'm trying to encourage the kind of society in which everybody can have an opportunity to speak. And I think there are a lot of people whose voices are not heard today who ought to be heard, who have the same right to be heard as everybody else. Basically, what I see all around me are that people in power tend to want to stay in power and tend to be somewhat insecure and tend to want to repress ideas that differ from their own. They don't like dissent. I think that's too bad. And we see this on the part of government, but we also see it on the part of private corporations, and I think that's an important point to make. The story was told me of by one of the leading black disc jockeys in the country, the first job he ever held in the South, working for a white-owned station, but one that was beamed principally at the black community. And he was handed a stack of 40 records and told, here, go spin these. And he said, well, I'd like to read a little news on the hour. Would you mind if I do that? And the manager said, I sure would. He said, you're not going to educate the Negroes of this community at my expense.
That story, obviously, that's in Mr. Johnson's book, Nick Johnson's book, is the metaphor for what it's all about. In case the audience may have tuned in late, you listen to a voice from Washington, a public official, a public servant in the genuine sense, Nicholas Johnson, member of the FCC. Back to the theme, it was Pete Seeger in the Harvard Alumni magazine and on this program, when the beautiful possibilities of mass media. You were talking about every point of view, since the air does belong to the public, that there should be some time, prime time, allowed on all stations, staggering all networks, in which any point of view, no matter how outrageous it be, because you have faith in the intelligence of the public, as we come back to that theme again.
Sure. Well, and moreover, I think that there are great segments of the American people that really never see themselves or people with whom they can relate on television, and I think there's great beauty and great strength in this country, and you can take a television camera and go out and talk to people. You don't have to take a bunch of professional performers and put them inside a studio with all those lights and the cement blocks and the sets and all that stuff. There are a lot of real life is after all what it's all about. As Mason Williams says, whenever television gets off into life, it gets lost.
Yeah.
Or another one of his lines is, television rehearses before it makes love.
Yes.
I mean, it just, it can't be spontaneous. It seemingly can't deal with the real world. Reality is too controversial today. Reality is too controversial.
Now
it's upsetting to people.
That leads to something, the controversial aspect of reality. Now and then we hear someone denied time on the air or censored or bleeped out, whether it be Judy Collins on the Dick Cavett Show, or whether it be Abby Hoffman blacked out on the Merv Griffin Show, or whether it be Smothers Brothers knocked off altogether, that they're controversial. And you're saying the very nature of life is controversial. That blandness, then, a bland program, is a, reflects a point of view. Blandness
of
is
course.
A point of view.
Of course, it's a point
That's
of view.
That's controversial.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah. And no, you're quite right. There have been a number of instances in which people have been blipped off. But, of course, as Abby Hoffman points out, that's itself a form of communication. That communicates we are living in a country in which there is corporate censorship. What they generally do, as Tommy Smothers pointed out, is they don't blip things out. What they generally do is just very carefully paste the tape back together so you don't know what they've taken out. And that's really much more treacherous. It's the ideas that never get on. Or the fellow preparing documentaries, and he has an idea for a show, and he presents it, and it gets turned down, and then he presents another idea, and that gets turned down, and by now he's becoming a little suspicious, and he presents a third idea, and it gets turned down. By now he knows his people just don't want controversial stuff on the air, and then he comes up with the next idea, and he doesn't even present it because he knows it's going to be turned down. And the final stage, and the most dangerous, is when he stops even having the ideas.
Now we come to it, don't we? Now we come to one of the bases of the horror, the possible horrors, and some of the actual horrors, as against the great possibilities, self-censorship.
Yes.
Something happens to that creative person that makes him makes him a thing.
That's right. That's right. And that can happen to the best of us. It's just a function of what environment you happen to find yourself in. Man is very adaptable.
Yeah. Good or bad.
Sure, and most people tend to do what is expected of them by the environment in which they happen to be located. And if you're living amongst people who encourage individuality and individual expression, you will tend to develop in that way. And if you're living amongst people or working in an environment or for a company where independence is not encouraged and expression of diverse views is not encouraged, to be a company man means that you mouth the same views that anyone else does or that you don't have any views at all, you very quickly adapt to that. You learn very fast.
And so we're talking about a certain time which we live, the last third of the 20th century, of communications, rather than communication, someone said, Wright Morris, the novelist. So we're talking about the most powerful medium for communications, TV and to some extent radio. And you're saying it can be used either way. And you're speaking about this media used in an open society.
That's right. That's right. And there's just so many wonderful things that television could be. It could show the American people each other what we're really like, what's going on in the country, what real people are thinking and believing and doing, the good things they're doing as well as the bad. It could it could help to educate us and enliven us. And look at Sesame Street, for example. There's a prime case, a marvelous program, and produced really with relatively little money by commercial television standards, has done more for the education of the under 5-year-olds in this country than the Head Start program or the preschools of the country or certainly any television program before. And that's the kind of thing that could have been done by commercial television 20 years ago. It wasn't done. They're motivated to maximize their profits, to sell products to anybody in sight, and that's about the end of their sense of responsibility.
So we come again to this recurring theme. There's a double thread in Nicholas Johnson's book, How to Talk Back to Your TV Set, that Atlantic Little Brown have published. The double theme is the horrendous aspect of the medium TV specifically, used to demean us, to make us consumers, to make us Strasbourg geese. And there's the possibility for its remarkable way of opening windows and doors for us. And so we come to entertainment, another aspect that you talk about in your book. An entertaining show, entertainment as against educational or as against political. But that entertaining show, that very bland, and maybe accept it as a dull, drab show, it has a point of view, and
oh,
that's
sure,
the point of view.
Sure, sure.
That life is empty and dull, and maybe this is the way we want it.
Yeah, I've made the point that everything on television is educational television in the sense that everything on television teaches something. The only question is, what is it teaching? Look at the commercials, for example. What do the commercials teach us? Because the commercials, after all, make up a substantial proportion of the total programming on television. At least 25% of the programming, generally more. What are the commercials teaching? Well, I think they're teaching us about conspicuous consumption, that happiness and personal satisfaction is to be found not in the development of one's skills or in self-discipline, but in the acquisition and consumption of products. It teaches us that the way to resolve human conflict is through violence rather than through compromise and cooperation, and so forth. Or the total impact of television on the whole drug culture. I mean, this is a, you know, everybody's very excited about young people smoking marijuana. But this is a part of a society in which all kinds of drugs are used constantly by all kinds of people. And television teaches this. If you have a headache, you take aspirin. If you have a you know, tension, take Compose. If you want to go to sleep, you take Nitol or whatever it's called. If you want to wake up, you take some pep pill or what's that caffeine thing. We've got tranquilizers and pep pills, and we've got all kinds of things that people are popping into their mouths as the chemical solution to life's problems. Well, if you bring up people thinking that they can solve their problems, well, then there are all kinds of ways you can take them. You can smoke and get nicotine, or you can drink coffee and get caffeine. I mean, you can drink and get alcohol, which is a drug, of course, and one that does much more damage in our society. Alcoholism, tremendous consumption of alcohol in this country. All the injury, loss of work, and human misery that results from consumption of alcohol. Television encourages this approach to an evaluation of life, you see. Now, after you've brought kids up watching these commercials and making them believe that there's a chemical to solve all of life's problems, well, we can be disappointed, but I don't really think we can be surprised when they come up with a chemical that they think is better than the one that Mommy and Daddy is using.
Well, listen to Nicholas Johnson talk. If I were President NAB, I wouldn't like you either.
Yeah, well, they don't. There are now 5 state associations of broadcasters that are urging my impeachment. This was a very popular move at one time, and they picked up new followers rapidly until someone discovered that there was no procedure for impeaching an FCC commissioner, and so it's kind of lost steam recently.
But what you've said, this is fantastic. Thus far, as we listen to Nicholas Johnson, and this is based upon the writings and reflections in his book, How to Talk Back to Your TV Set. I'm sure the listeners are, well, I'm just guessing they're quite excited, the writings, and that you say that something can be done, but your point, basic truth, that the air does belong to the public.
That's right.
And these agencies, these broadcast companies, networks, advertisers, all are there under, through our good offices, really.
That's right, in the same way that your congressman is. Absolutely. The United States Court of Appeals has said in this regard, that has made just that analogy, that a broadcaster must, like an elected public official, quite literally run on his record.
And yet you point out the power more and more, this concentration of power. The word conglomerate, I know, is now a popular word, and even in Washington people worry about it to some extent. The conglomerate, as far as mass media is concerned,
yes,
is more and more tight than ever, isn't it now, the control?
I think so. There are a number of problems that come about through ownership. Basically, you know, a lot of people don't know who owns the stations that they listen to, or who owns the newspapers that they read, or the magazines that they read, or the book publishers. They don't know who these owners are. And when you track it down, it can become quite frightening. I was on a show not long ago, a television show, another city, and the lady who was hosting the show didn't know who owned the station. The problem, of course, is that the person who owns the station ultimately has editorial control. Now, they can talk about how, well, we have different editorial policies on this newspaper and that newspaper and this station and that station and so forth and so on. But in point of fact, when they want to crack down, they can, by changing editors, by changing policies and so forth. There can be as much diversity as they permit, and some permit a great deal, and I appreciate that. But they have that ultimate power to cut it off whenever and however quickly they want to. Boss Tweed walked into the New York Times in 1871 and offered $5 million to the Times if it would kill a single story. Now, I should add that the Times did not kill the story. But the point is that it illustrates that there is a marketplace value on what it is worth to someone to control the news. That's a very valuable possession, worth even more than the fantastic revenues that they make and the private profits they make from this operation. Owners do control the content. They can control the content. They do have this power, and we better recognize it. We better find out who those owners are. Now, there are many cities in the United States that this problem of ownership exists in many contexts. There are many cities in the United States where a single man owns the only newspaper and the only television station in that town. There are many cities where a major newspaper owns a major television station. This is the problem of local monopoly. Second problem is that of regional concentration, where a single company or owner will be a very dominant voice throughout a region of the country, an entire state or a part of a state or many states. The third problem is the multiple ownership of a given kind of media, a string of newspapers, a string of television stations. A fourth problem is the multimedia owner, the single company that owns not only broadcast properties, but also newspapers, and perhaps also cable television, and magazines, and book publishers, and film producers, and recording companies, and so forth. Here the problem is that they do have an economic and an ideological control over the property, over the music, the books, the whatnot, over the talent, the authors, the performers. And the fifth problem is this problem of conglomerate control. The problem of the conglomerate. A conglomerate is basically an industrial enterprise which has many diverse and unrelated businesses. Somebody who's in the steel business and the fertilizer business and the taxi cab business and the bed clothing business or something. Basically, they're in the money business, that's all. And they're in the finance business. And they bring all these companies together. Now, when that kind of a holding company, that kind of an industrial conglomerate, also has a mass media outlet, there are those of us on the commission who believe that you are taking a substantial risk that that conglomerate can, if it wants to, and that it often does want to, and occasionally will, you're taking a risk that that conglomerate will use its mass media subsidiary as if it were a part of its advertising agency or its public relations firm, that it will use it to promote the best interests of the other subsidiaries of that holding company, it will use it to suppress information it doesn't want to get out, use it to put out information it does want out, and so forth. And there is sufficient evidence that I've documented here in How to Talk Back Your Television Set on instances in which that has been done.
Well, this chapter and verse is cited by Nicholas Johnson in this powerful book. There's still a few moments remaining and so many questions to ask Mr. Johnson to the power. Basically now, before you talked about censorship, about possibilities in the mass media, I want to ask you about cable TV perhaps, but power is against impotence of the person who thinks he's impotent, not a guy like John Banzhoff. That Congress itself is afraid of the power of broadcast. Since you speak of congressional elections, 60% of the dough is spent on TV and radio. Yes. So therefore, broadcast has tremendous impact on Congress and the Senate.
Oh, there's no question about that. I think the broadcasting industry is probably, without question, the single most powerful lobby in the history of our country. They can get virtually any single piece of legislation they want from Congress. I think that's a very dangerous situation. There's nothing wrong with the elected officials. They're caught up in a system over which they really have no control. But it's a system that's virtually totally dominated by big broadcasting at this time. Big broadcasting that provides the time and big business that provides the money to buy the time.
But something has happened. Perhaps it's the Democratic Convention. Perhaps it's Nicholas Johnson himself. I lean toward the role of Mr. Johnson here. Something has happened the past couple of years. There seems to be more awareness, isn't there, to some extent? Do you sense this, perhaps on the part of the young more than others, of the possibilities of challenging conglomerates or monopolistic control?
Oh, I think so, yes. I think there's a growing awareness that power in this country rests not with elected officials, but with the large corporations that really control our lives. Who makes the decision as to whether the automobiles coming out of Detroit are going to emphasize styling or going to emphasize safety? There's no popular control over that. Who determines what wage rates those companies are going to pay? There's no popular control over that, you see. Who determines what rights the professional people are going to have who work for those companies, whether they're going to be free to speak their minds? There's no popular control over that. That's where the who determines whether these factories are going to be moved around the country, leaving unemployment in some places and creating economic prosperity in other places. There's no popular control over that. There are many corporations in this country that individually have a greater gross income every year than many foreign governments have in their entire federal budgets. That's where the power lies. And I think more and more we're coming to realize in a democratic country, you have to have checks on power wherever that power may be located. It's not simply enough to have checks on governmental power.
So perhaps there's also a theme here, new possibilities for TV, cable TV, which is something wholly new, wholly different.
Yes.
And the great question you ask here, again, the question, who will control the switch?
That's right.
Who will hold the switch? The book is, I hope you return again soon. Nicholas Johnson is our guest, member of the Federal Communications Commission, holder of office, believe it or not, in Washington, D.C. How to talk back to your TV set, Atlantic Little Brown, the publishers. One last personal question. Are you 35 years old?
Yes.
Oh, Nicholas Johnson could be candidate for president of the United States. The book is How to Talk Back to Your Television Set. Thank you very much.
Thank you.